Well, welcome back, everybody. We're now going to move ahead and engage in some brisk discussion, exchange of views, hopefully, again, gravitation towards some actionable solutions that could make a difference in the rate of health cost, health spending growth, and still get us the other things that we want out of healthcare. So just to briefly recap what we've heard so far this morning. First of all, we heard from Joe Antos that technology is a factor both in terms of the supply of and demand for it. There is has been some discussion about whether technology can directly be measured as a contributor to health costs. Often it's not and is treated, as he said, as a residual. It's the I don't know factor. If I can't explain it by other for other reasons, I call it technology. Nonetheless, as he pointed out, we can clearly see the role of technology. He gave a number of those historical examples of how technology has evolved over time. He offered a list of some, a menu of some options, some of which he thought had some possible workability attached to them, and others of which he was a little bit dubious about. One of those was comparative effectiveness research. But that notwithstanding, there's a lot that we can do even within some of the constraints that exist, for example, in terms of the Medicare program. He mentioned coverage with evidence development. Notwithstanding the fact that Medicare is, as he said, a political program, some of these changes could be made or some of these tools could be used more effectively than they are now, and that there at least is some prospect of reining in some aspect of technology-driven health spending growth that we don't want and don't need. We then heard from Ken Thorpe about how it now looks as if 60% of the spending growth over the last couple of decades has been attributable to the growing treated prevalence of chronic disease. Much of this, as he said, is driven by rising obesity, whether it's diabetes or other or cardiovascular disease or other conditions that are linked to diabetes. He spent a good amount of time talking about some of the problems that we've encountered with respect to these populations, lack of care coordination, lack of use of interventions that we know work. He mentioned the diabetes prevention program and the substantial evidence we have that loss of 5 to 7% of body weight can halt progression of prediabetes to diabetes and really, as he said, should be a rather low-cost intervention that could be rolled out rather broadly. That plus care coordination in many respects he mentioned as a real force that could arrest some of the health spending growth that has been attributed to those causes. We then heard from our reactors in sequence, Melanie Bella first talking about the duals, the dual eligibles who are her purview as the poster children for this mix of chronic disease technology and costs. And we heard, of course, about a number of the pilots that CMS has underway now to look for ways to improve the care of those individuals, decrease the churn back and forth between hospitals and nursing homes, et cetera, and reduce rate of cost there. We heard from Joe Newhouse that the problem of rising growth in health spending, those growth rates, is really a problem that is ubiquitous across the world, and that notwithstanding the fact that the U.S. has a higher level, the real issue than these other countries, the real issue is this rate of growth of cost. However, as he mentioned, nothing grows to the sky. Joe, I was reminded of Herb Stein's famous comment that things that cannot go on forever will stop. And you mentioned that we are probably going to halt this dramatic rates of growth in health spending. You just don't know exactly how. We'd love to hear you perhaps address whether we maybe are in the midst of that stopping now with consumer-directed health plans and high-deductible health plans and people not being able to afford care and all of the other things that we know are a factor currently. We heard from Jim Fasulis of the American College of Cardiology about the beneficial aspects, really, of a lot of the technology that we have adopted with respect to cardiovascular disease, particularly as evident in the 30% reduction in mortality from cardiovascular disease just in the last decade. Nonetheless, as he pointed out, there are things going on in cardiovascular care that shouldn't be done or are done excessively. That led to the ACC's recommendations as part of the Choosing Wisely campaign, the five interventions not to allow your physician to suggest that you have. As he noted, that coupled with a lot of quality improvement efforts underway at various institutions, we're improving the quality of cardiovascular care and perhaps reducing some of the unnecessary care driven by certain technologies. We heard from Diane Rowland about the very important fact that the high spenders in the Medicare program are different from the high spenders in the Medicaid program, which is a recipe for us developing a much more nuanced understanding about how to restrain excess costs in those two pockets of the population. We heard from Bruce Chernoff, again, much on that same theme, that half of the Medicare enrollees with chronic conditions also have functional limitations. Half of them are dual eligibles, but half are not. And we have to be very mindful of, he said, of the problem that we're trying to solve. The problem, as many patients see it, is that they lack all of those words that he put up in his wonderful word cloud. They're not spending a lot of time thinking about how to get access to surgical robots. They're spending more time thinking about how to have independent, dignified existence, independent of as many healthcare providers as possible very often. And then we heard from Susan Reinhardt that patients and caregivers sense that a lot of the issues that they face in healthcare is due to factors such as poor communication. They don't feel that they are empowered sufficiently often to make decisions with their healthcare providers. They're also clearly lacking in health literacy. She gave a number of examples underscoring that. And that they too would very much like to engage in much more constructive dialogue with their healthcare providers about how to have the care systems that they really want and that deliver on some of those wonderful words that Bruce mentioned in his word cloud. So with that, the floor is open now for a greater discussion about how we move forward, knit some of these issues together, and continue to work on actionable solutions to press forward. Joe, did you want to answer the question I just briefly tossed out at you before we get going?
Sure. Well, I would distinguish again between the level of costs and the growth rate of costs, or this is the phrase that was fashionable a while back, but I haven't heard a lot lately, bend the curve on growth rates. So there's a lot of evidence that higher cost sharing and consumer direct health plans will reduce the level. There's not much evidence, if any, about growth rates. There's some evidence that the supply side interventions we're throwing out there will affect levels. They could affect growth rates. I could make a theoretical case they will. I don't think there's much evidence on that. So I don't want to make that sound terribly negative, because at a minimum, just even if one just changes the level, it buys time and frees up resources for other activities. But since I think the growth rate is the issue, exactly how to attack the growth rate, I think we're still doing a lot of trial and error.
Okay.
That will be fodder for future health affairs articles.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. David Nexon.
Just a sort of follow-up on your question to Joe. I mean, I do think that the understanding the differences between societies is really interesting, to know that we have the far and away the highest actual level, but a growth rate that's similar to other societies. But in terms of a policy prescription, I'm not sure that there's quite as clear a dichotomy. I mean, if you can knock 1% off the level, you know, for example, by reducing chronic disease or improving care coordination for the next 20 years, you know, 1% a year, then you cut the growth rate essentially 1% for the next 20 years as well. So I'm not sure that from a policy point of view that distinction is entirely as important as it may be in terms of a scientific or understanding the differences point of view.
No, I agree with that. That's what I meant by buying time, and why I said I agreed with the prescriptions that Ken had put out about interventions. It's certainly worthwhile, but I think it's the framework is to think about what interventions would change the rate of growth. It's not really advice not to do something that we know will change the level.
Yes, Julie.
I'm Corey Uccello from the American Academy of Actuaries. So we talked a little bit about this last month when we held this, and this was something we actually talked about in our medical technical panel meetings, this level versus growth issue, and we might be asking too much to say that something has a permanent long-term reduction in growth for and thinking more along the lines of, well, there's going to be a series of shorter-term reductions that then taken together will bend the curve. So, you know, thinking about, you know, we can't expect one thing to have a permanent long-term change in things. And so how do we think about constantly evolving and moving forward with new changes over time?
Is that Stu?
Let me go a little further than David and Corey just went. I'm not sure there's really a real distinction at all between level and growth rate, because to say there is means there's some kind of mechanism that generates a growth rate in health spending, and I'm not sure there is. I think a growth in health spending just means a change in the level from one year to the next. So if you go back to what Don Berwick's been talking about lately, you know, these wedges what increases health spending is a bunch of decisions that are made every day, and then they get made again the next day and the next day and the next day. So there's not really a process that you can identify to kind of target the growth rate separately from the level of health spending. You need to look at the level of health spending and address what's in there that you can then, you know, kind of not have more of unnecessarily. So I'm not sure that it leads us to a productive set of policies to try and separate those two things too much.
Actually, I think there are mechanisms. But the point, I think the reason to distinguish level and growth is that once you've gotten out inefficiencies and waste, you've done it. And then you're back with some steady state rate of growth. So, yes. To David Nexon's point, to your point, I could save 1% a year. But, for example, I could do that by raising a deductible. But at some point, it gets ridiculous, and it doesn't serve the purpose of risk sharing. Or I could do it by putting more risk on providers. But once I've got a maximal risk on providers, I've done that. The two colleagues, my two colleagues at CMS and I published a piece that's in your book on mechanisms, to go to Stuart's point on mechanisms, and we talked about income changes over time, which are certainly common across the developed countries. And this goes partly to Joe Antos's talk, we thought that accounted for 29 to 43% of the change in growth, and we thought that interacted with technology, again to go to Joe Antos's point, and that interaction was another 27 to 49%. The insurance changes mattered less. I do think there's some in our data, and we're looking now across the OECD, and the demographic changes matter just a little bit. So it, and now chronic diseases, to go to Ken's point, are also increasing, I think, throughout the developed world. Certainly diabetes is increasing throughout. So that in, I think in going forward, that's also going to be driving cost, as he said. But again, I think all of these things are different aspects of the same reality. But I do think there is a mechanism that's driving the growth rates.
See, I think Dallas Salisbury had a hand up.
Yeah, just a quick follow-on that set of points is, in work that Paul Freinston's been doing with a database that we now have, that has 7 years of data pre and post design change by a major employer. This goes both to Joe's point that it makes sense and Joe Antis's point of this is where there is some, end quotes, freedom of innovation. The most common change on the private side over the last 5 years has been moving to far more shifting to an individual, high deductible, HSA, HRA, et cetera. This particular company did all of that. It produced a, when one does the analysis and allows the analysis to have all of the new entrants flow in, which based on looking at the literature is the way most of the analysis by insurers and others has been doing it, then you see a not only an initial decrease in cost, but what appears to be a decrease in the rate of cost growth. In this particular case, the second you take out and do the analysis on a closed group basis, so all you're doing is following the individuals that were with the employer in the plan prior to the change, and then carry them through the first 5 years, you get a one-time shift down, similar to the old managed care shift. And then the cost rate actually is slightly higher than it is for the end quotes full population. So we haven't been able to find other studies that have been making that closed group analysis process in it. So there may be the appearance of good news out there that isn't quite as good vis-a-vis what is happening. The second point I'd make, which goes a bit to what Ken was talking about and others on the chronic issue, and I'll flip to an article that a fairly thorough piece that was in Health Affairs with a much lengthier piece that then followed it in the Washington Post on Lyme disease. And if you take the state of Virginia, where when the current governor came in, he for the first time appointed a governor's task force. The governor's task force came up with recommendations. The governor said, we shall enforce the recommendations. The state health department began an immediate process of sending out mailings and creating educational requirements for all those licensed to practice in any way within the health system in the state of Virginia, and the rate of test positive reported cases of Lyme in the state of Virginia has skyrocketed, as it is also at CDC the highest rate of reported growth across 48 states at the moment, as it is becoming through health affairs, popular media, gubernatorial task forces. That is a disease that the Infectious Disease Society treats as an acute disease. It can be easily cured, they say. And for those that think they have a chronic disease, who are in a wheelchair after treatment, who still can't chew after treatment, et cetera, these are all deemed to be non-Lyme related and non-treatable. Those that are told they have MLS, chronic fatigue syndrome, et cetera. So this goes to the dual eligibles, the Medicaid, the Medicare, one of the fastest rates of increase in granting of Social Security disability and with it Medicaid coverage is, in fact, Lyme disease individuals who, according to the IDC, the infectious disease people, don't have Lyme disease, but relative to the chronic conditions do. So it's just to underline a number of the comments, both on the treatment issues, on the analysis and diagnosis issues, and to the technology issue of testing, the fact that Lyme testing, as the article in Health Affairs pointed out and elsewhere has been pointed out, is an extraordinarily ineffective, very high rate of false negatives test, And there's a tremendous need for advance in that area. But even with a lousy test, it is suddenly producing new costs that will push the cost growth curve as we move in this area. So the employer side, Joe, I agree with you. There has not been a tremendous movement, if one looks at the magnitude of that system, towards a significant change. Those that are making the shift to high deductible and in essence thinking they've found nirvana, when you've cut the data, just looking at a constant population, nirvana still is a long ways off. But to the point raised by others, a one-time decrease of 17% before it starts going up again is not necessarily a bad thing. But then I'll add the final caveat. HSAs, as established under federal law, the data is not owned by the employer. And in fact, in most cases, only one of the insurance carriers is structuring their products so that they actually can do an analysis that includes what is being spent out of the health savings account. And even with them, because the law allows the employee to move the HSA provider bank and then there's no reporting back, is the vast majority of the research to date excludes from analysis what is being spent out of health savings accounts and treats that spending as not occurring. So the data on that whole area is exceedingly dirty.
Comments, anybody? Okay, let's see. I think Michael Barr is next.
Thanks, Susan. I'm going to go in a slightly different direction, if that's okay. It's been refreshing, at least for me, that we've been in a meeting about 2.5 hours on the role of technology in chronic conditions, since nobody's mentioned the phrase meaningful use, which is nice, but I'm about to change this. I have a question for the panel. In full disclosure, I'm on the Health IT Policy Committee Meaningful Use Work Group, and there are 4 subgroups now working on different ideas for Stage 3. But I'm curious from the panelists whether they think Stage 1 and the proposed objectives and measures for Stage 2 are moving in the right direction in terms of helping us to improve our chronic conditions and manage costs. And whether you think so or not, what would you recommend for Stage 3?
2 words. Total interoperability. Until you get that, you can throw out meaningful use and this, that, and the other thing and say that, but until you have the different EHR speaking to each other and the data being transmitted from the specialist to the primary care with 2 different systems, you can measure all you want, but it's not going to help us. It's still going to be inefficient for the practitioner.
Bruce?
I guess the comment I would make is, so where is functional assessment in all this? And I, you know, again, as a practicing physician, I get the value of all the little data points that we love to collect. But when you look at the population that both Diane and I show data about, and if you reflect through on Melanie's broader comments about her kind of current focus and the pre-duals, until we understand the role of function and both physical impairment and cognitive impairment, you know, you can write prescriptions and stuff, and you can do tests and stuff till the cows come home. But if you can't understand whether you can, you know, sort of thread that data set through the life of a fully built human being, that's a real problem. And I see that as being totally missing.
Brad.
In the spirit of specific recommendations to reduce cost and connecting the dots, I want to follow up on something Bruce has been saying, and that is the importance of functional impairment. And it's not just because, you know, people, when they can't function, you know, utilize. It's that multiple chronic conditions plus functional impairment, those just happen to be 2 of the most powerful predictors we have for mortality. And the bottom line really is that if you look at the population that has more than 3 chronic illness diagnoses and functional impairment, you're looking at people who are getting near the end of life, where spending is very high. We all know that in Medicare, 28% of all Medicare dollars go to patients in the last year of life. 30% of that 28% is in the last month of patients' lives, and 80% of that is in the hospital. I thought the articles that were supplied today are really interesting. The AMED News one, Who Are the Chronically Costly? Healthcare's 1%. This is the population that we're talking about. As Ken mentioned, death panel rhetoric has kind of paralyzed the debate on what to do about these folks. But I just want to suggest that the managed care approach of targeting costs and thereby reducing utilization, there's a word for that, and it's rationing. And it caused managed care to be torpedoed across the country, and we saw what happened in one of the graphs we saw today. I would submit to you that the targeting costs in order to reduce utilization in this high-cost, vulnerable population is exactly a 180 opposite of the way we ought to be going. What we should be doing is looking at the word cloud. Hospice, those of us that have done hospice for years know that you can be a day away from death and be very comfortable, very functional, believe it or not, very happy. At home, all the words in the word cloud are fulfilled, and we can target those kinds of personal preferences in order to drive reduced utilization, because a lot of these folks do not want to go back to the hospital. If you start with personal preference and then reduce costs, that's the right direction, and nobody's going to argue with that, except for those who just think personal choice is just a bad word. But out in the real world, what people want should be driving what kind of care they get, and we don't have mechanisms to make that happen, except in the few places where we've trained teams to be in the home and community to move the focus of care out of the hospital for this population to where it needs to be, where the word cloud is fulfilled. I just want to put in a plug, really, and by the way, I'm a palliative care doc times 20 years, and I do not think palliative care by itself is the answer, because it's viewed by most physicians as an alternative to treatment. So it's either we treat, and when we're done treating, we turn over to palliative care or hospice. That doesn't work. I can attest to that, with decades of frustration. What does work is to train teams to see what people want and do both treatment and comfort care in a package. We can do that, and we are. I want to put in a plug for CTAC, Coalition to Transform Advanced Care, which is here in D.C., putting into process and measuring results on exactly what we're talking about. And I think next meeting it would be great to go into this in more depth, because I do think it's a way forward.
Great. Yep. Please, Jim.
I've been talking to students about shared decision-making, or by some other name, for a long time, and I would write down on a blackboard a utility function, and then everything flowed. And I just went with my wife to see a lawyer about redoing our wills, and so I got to thinking about what one would say in advance directives. It's very hard. I mean, we know from all sorts of studies that people are bad at complex decisions, which this is. They're bad at probabilistic decisions, which this is. They're bad in emotional contexts, which this is. I'd like to think I'm pretty good at that, but just trying to say, either orally or in writing, to my wife or my children what I would want, there's such a vast range of circumstances looking forward that, you know, the simple kind of example we give people about the doctor says, well, you have a X percent chance of survival, and, you know, and by the way, here's what will happen, what kind of pain and suffering you go through. It isn't like that, and probably most doctors aren't very good at giving those probabilities anyway. So while I'm kind of all for bringing in the patient, I'd have to turn in my union card as an economist if I wasn't. I think it's just actually very, very hard to do this in practice and then pretend that we've made a big advance. Now, that's not to say in some cases we clearly could do this. I have no doubt about that. But as one starts to push this and gets close to it, I think it's hard. I'd be interested in what Brad has to say about it.
Yeah, if I could respond, I have to say, Joe, I agree completely with what you just said. As a doc in an office and in the hospital and the ICU, or talking with attorneys, a one-shot conversation on advanced care planning yields very little. I think if there's a secret to this, it's that as people get more and more ill within this period, where none of us, if you're sitting at the table, you're not this sick, okay? The people we're talking about couldn't be here. They can't even make it to their doctor's office or to church. I mean, they're very ill. Once you get that sick and move through your illness, if you have a trained team there helping you understand what the illness is about and helping you understand what your real options are, one of which, of course, is 911 when you lose your breath at 4 in the morning, there's others as well. The interesting thing about the word cloud is that the people who are the most ill have the capacity to live just like the words in the cloud, but we teach them to come back to the hospital. We don't teach them to manage themselves, to see what their options are, and we don't put help for them in their homes. And I think that's why I think what you're saying leads us to the place where we have to do better care coordination in the community, and we have models and data showing that that works. Because you can't do advanced care planning when you're well. It is too complicated, and you're not down the decision tree far enough to know what's going to happen. Once you're that sick, you do know what's happening, and you've adapted, and that's when decisions over time with trained teams make a difference.
Ken?
I know I mentioned this in my talk, but I guess just wanted to reiterate that I think we could do three simple things. They're not going to solve the problem, but they are going to contribute to the solution set, and they'd be inexpensive. So we're not looking at something that's a big set of expenditures. You know, one is on this prevention side. So as I talked about, if you look at a pre-diabetic overweight adult at age 50, they have an 87% chance of having diabetes during their life. If you enroll them in this diabetes prevention program I just talked about, lifetime likelihood of getting diabetes is 62%. So that's a program that we should just roll out nationally and then leverage Medicare to refer patients into it. That's a program we could do for $80 million. So that's less than 10% of the prevention and public health fund next year. So I'd do that. I'd make it a covered benefit in Medicare. It doesn't have to be the DPP, but something like that. Second is that we have got to build evidence-based care coordination into traditional fee-for-service Medicare. It makes no sense that that's really the only payer that doesn't have any type of care coordination. And as we've heard, they own the chronically ill population. I mean, that's where they are. And so we do know from a whole host of data from the private sector, from randomized trials, functions that improve clinical outcomes and reduce costs. And I went through some of those, like transitional care, health coaching, medication therapy management, and so on. And there are evidence-based models across the board on those that we should just integrate into fee-for-service Medicare. And the third thing that we could do is pay attention in the definition of essential health benefits for plans offering services in the exchanges about what do we mean by prevention and care coordination. We spent a lot of time on the other elements, defining what inpatient care is and so on. We're spending no time really thinking through what do we expect plans to do in terms of preventive services. And I'm not talking about clinical preventive services. I'm really talking about disease aversion and care coordination for plans and exchanges. And I think that's a really important discussion to have with states, with health plans, because there's going to be an incredible amount of transition of patients from Medicaid to private health plans within the exchanges. And I just think that that's something that at the state level we need to get on. That obviously in terms of cost, minimal, if any, but those are three things that we could do right now, I think that would make a real important contribution to reducing hopefully both the Loveland trends.
Ken, I just want to follow up on your point about prevention and the diabetes prevention program, because, as you know, a large share of the long-term analyses of that program show that, notwithstanding the fact that many people do lose that 5 to 7% of body weight, a very large share of them actually gain it back. Now, there still is a benefit, as you said, in terms of at least delaying progression from pre-diabetes to diabetes, or causing it to cease in some people. But it gets to this issue that I think Joe Newhouse has put back on the table, which is that it turns out people do not operate in their best interests. We are now quite aware from the field of behavioral economics. Do we understand really enough about human behavior to know that these interventions are going to have a lasting effect?
Well, we know the two facts that I laid out in terms of the long-term likelihood of getting diabetes for somebody at age 50. Again, we're sort of paralyzed here with not doing anything without having years of randomized trials. It's a good thing the private sector doesn't work that way, but Medicare does. There is a 10-year follow-up of the DPP, and we know in the 10-year follow-up that, yes, there is some weight regain after year three or four, but that just means that we should focus on what can we do in year three and four to reinforce it. I guess that's the first point. The second point that I'd say, so what? It still has a 34% cumulative reduction in the incidence of diabetes within a 10-year time period. So compared to doing nothing, we have 34% less.
All right. So one of the elements on the table clearly then is adopt the diabetes prevention program nationally. You said $80 million a year.
Not used to talking about M's. We're used to talking about B's. But it's $80 million. Yeah, I could ask for more. It sounds more attractive if it costs more, I guess. But $80 million, yeah.
Jim, what is?
I'd like to go back to Dr. Stewart's comment about end of life and issues. And I think one of the things in teaching residents that we forget to do is we're teaching them the technology, so they start using the technology. And what we don't teach them is just because we can use something, should we use something? That thought process. It's far easier to provide something in a setting of end of life or something like that without thinking than not doing it. You feel better because you're trying, even if it's a hopeless case. So I think this also gets to the point we've mentioned a little bit about patient-centered medical home, and some of us talked at the break about that, is we need to look at understanding the use of the technology both by the primary care doc and by the specialist, and make sure there's a coordination in the use of that technology, both in the setting of the first workup of the disease and also in the setting at the end of life, where a lot of technology is used that really is not going to aid or help the patient in the diagnosis, the treatment, or even in the comfort like you presented. So I think one thing we haven't looked at or discussed is actually getting back into the teaching realm of the medical schools and the residencies and understanding, getting them to understand the use of technology better.
And to get them to work as teams. I mean, as I look in at any academic medical center, we've got a school of public health, a medical school, a nursing school, a school of pharmacy, a school of social work. They're all going to see the same patient at some point during the course of that patient's treatment. But there isn't a structure that really gets them to work together to think about how do we work collectively as a team to keep that patient either from getting the disease or healthy.
And I would just add, there was a editorial, I think, in the New York Times a couple months ago that internal medicine has to get more like pediatrics. My training is pediatric cardiology, and believe me, we had a social worker, a pharmacologist. They knew how to pull up the if they were giving drugs, how to do the bottle. They didn't leave the hospital until parents could give the meds, could give it appropriately. Even if it cost the hospital an extra day and wasn't reimbursed, the patient didn't go home until the appointment was made and our appointment was made.
Bruce?
Well, maybe to build on that a little bit, I think about my sort of limited public health training when I was in medical school, but it actually had a framework that said there were three levels of prevention and there was primary prevention. And somehow most of the discussions I'm involved in these days seem to focus on prevention in a very primary kind of way, which is all about preventing people from getting that. You know, care coordination is all about those other two kinds of preventions, for people who are sick and possibly treatable and for people who are sick and treatable but not curable. And so I think we need to get back to this notion that a really good care coordination plan is actually a form of prevention. It is a public health responsibility. And it's sort of missing, I mean, I'm sorry to sound so energized, but it's really missing from these discussions. And at the end of the day, I will go back to the question, which is what is the problem we're trying to solve here? And at the end of the day, we've developed a tradition in late 20th century American medicine of introducing a pill or a piece of equipment in place of a good discussion. And particularly in a situation when the outcome is functionally driven, not medically driven, you're not going to fix the fact that this person has had a substantial stroke and is now, you know, hemiplegic. So now you really have to focus on their quality of life. And frankly, you know, I agree it's a medical school issue. I mean, it's an issue at every level in the medical system because there isn't a good framework for care coordination, understanding what the person's medical and personal goals are, that we continually substitute expensive, potentially very risky therapies in place of a thoughtful and evolving care plan. When you are seriously ill or have substantial functional limitations, it's not a fixed point in time discussion. It's like a mosaic that evolves. And you have to be willing to pull some tiles out and change them around when the image changes. So there's a larger discussion about how we use technology, and part of why I think this kind of notion, you know, Melanie, as you guys think about the work you're doing, this notion of a really thoughtful care plan that's revisited over and over and over again. And my one fear about the fee-for-service Medicare piece is that somehow we'll get a piece of code that says once a year you get a care coordination visit, and then there's some little follow-up code, and it won't work. I mean, it just won't. So, you know, there's kind of an intensity in this intervention that's really important. And it goes back to, I think, the fundamentals of public health. Okay, I'm off the soapbox.
Could I add to that just very quickly? In the interest of actionable steps, there's been a lot of talk about what's effective care, how do we change medical culture, how do we teach residents. Our experience, I think, in a big 24-hospital system is the way to change medical culture is to change the structure of how the care is provided. And I have to say, as a doctor, that I don't think doctors are the answer. You know, there aren't enough of us to go around with the gray wave that's about to inundate us. The teamwork that we need are teams of other professionals that can work with us to extend our care to people who need it, the kind of people Bruce is talking about. And I think there are models out there that provide that kind of care coordination. We have data that show that it works. That simple change in the structure of how care is provided, just reengineering the system in that way, would really equip us to do a lot of the things we're talking about today and change medical culture in the process. Doctors want to be offloaded for caring for these people who can't make it into their offices anyway. They're too ill.
We have some more cards up, so let's go around the room this way. David Exon, and we'll work our way around.
I have a follow-up to the last couple of comments, a question really for Ken or Melanie or anybody else. I mean, on the issue of care coordination, team-delivered care, I think the common wisdom now is that this is really an important way to get at this high-cost population, but at the same time, it doesn't seem to be as simple as simply adding on a paid benefit. It seems to require both a structural change and a cultural change for a lot of caregivers. I wonder how we go about doing that in a program like Medicare or Medicaid, for that matter.
You're right. It's not a coding change. I sort of think about it the way that North Carolina and Vermont have gone about this in terms of building health teams that work with primary care practices. And the way I think you could do it in the Medicare program, and I would do it in conjunction too with the exchanges, is basically that you would have to contract out, like they do in Vermont, with different entities and different planned service areas to have teams available to work with Medicare patients. I would start off with them being voluntary. I mean, the primary care practices don't have to use them, but our experience in looking at them in Vermont is that they all do, because I think to Brad's point is that they are a natural extension of the office. They engage and work with the patients. They help them make sure they understand the care plan. The care plan is executed. They have questions about the care plan. They know where to go. They're nurses, nurse practitioners, pharmacists. They're really doing all the blocking and tackling and execution of the plans, and they're not physician-led. They're nurse-led. So I think you could, you know, very easily have Medicare build these teams and have them available for others to use. If Medicaid in the state want to do it, that'd be fine. A lot of states are doing this. And there's a section 2703 in the Affordable Care Act that gives states an enhanced 90% match to put these teams into place for 2 years. So I think in combination with that and Medicare, maybe through the Innovation Center, which I know they're doing some of this, that'd be a way to start building the capacity into the program. And you'd expect them to do some of the functions I just talked about. You'd expect them to do the functional assessments. You expect them to do some of the social functions, the medication therapy, transitional care coaching, work with them on health literacy issues. So we have experience. In Vermont, they do this with Medicare patients. In fact, the teams are used to manage all the patients in the provider practice. So the challenge we have is that, like any type of care coordination program, it requires an initial investment, right? So unless we're going to invest in it, we can't get any of the healthcare benefits, and you can't get any of the savings. So I would hope that through a combination of some Innovation Center money, we could start this going. We've been working with states to encourage them through Section 2703 to build out the health teams through the Medicaid program. And perhaps if you build some broad expectations in the exchanges about the types of functions that you would hope to have health plans provide and compete on, that would be a way to start moving more quickly down the field. I know that if we don't go that direction and build some type of evidence-based care coordination into Medicare, you know, the debate about how to save money in the Medicare program is going to be the same one we've had for 30 years. It's going to be cut provider payments, increase cost sharing, increase the age of eligibility. It's the same old, and it's not going to really get at any of these fundamental cost drivers that we've been talking about.
Susan, could I
just a quick comment about building anything into Medicare. I think Medicare's entire history proves conclusively that you really can't build common sense into Medicare. What you can do is provide incentives for health plans to use common sense. But it's only been 45 years so far. We'll see.
We're going to keep working our way this way, and I'll come back around. Carmela, we'll catch you up next, but I promise people. Forgive me, but you're so far away, I cannot even read name cards down at that end of the
room. Not a problem. Peter Bowers, I'm a medical director with WellPoint. So I appreciate this opportunity to speak briefly. And, you know, my day job is payment redesign across our 14 Blue plans. So we cover 1 in 9 Americans across total Blues is almost 100 million lives. And there are a number of different levels that we're using to change sort of this fee-for-service reimbursement, because we've got to change the system that people are getting care in. And all the things discussed, patient preference, very important, supporting physicians with data. IT is going to help that with interoperability. But one of the levers, and there are multiple levers that we're going to need to create, is one that I'd like to call attention to that touches on both chronic care and technology. And it's something that's across all Blue plans. Almost 100 million lives support this from a data perspective. And so a national cost comparison tool looks at over 200 commoditized type of entities of healthcare services, colonoscopy. Joe, you started with your cataract example. It shows cataracts. Total cost of care for members went from door to door, so it includes everything that is associated, prophy, facility, anesthesia. And it's very informative. Colonoscopy, for example. And heaven forbid, Joe, if you need an imaging this afternoon, all imaging for sciatica is on there as well, so you can be smart about where you spend your healthcare dollars. And this tool is really important because I think as we think about moving forward, the amount of information that flows to help you make better informed choices is coming in here. So appreciate the moment.
Great. Thank you. So we'll keep moving this way.
Yes, Kirsten Sloan with the National Partnership for Women and Families. I just wanted to touch on the care coordination that both Bruce and Brad referenced, because I think this really is a critical, actionable step. But I would also caution that part of that, that care coordination team really has to include the patient, because one of the things we consistently see is care plans written for the patient, care coordination done for the patient, but when it doesn't include the patient, when there isn't an understanding of where the patient is coming from or what they are capable of doing, oftentimes we fail. And so it isn't just to be nice to the patient, but this actually is a key to the success of a care plan or a care coordination effort, that we're using shared decision-making tools, that we are using things like self-management programs, which consumers and patients are actually asking for. But unless we engage them and the family caregivers as well, I think we're going to miss, and Susan's chart actually showed that people don't adhere to the kinds of treatment regimens that they're recommended, and instead we end up costing the system more. So if we can prevent hospitalizations, if we can prevent readmissions, because we've included that patient and that caregiver in the design of that care plan or the care management, I think that's a good actionable step.
Henry Claypool from HHS. I'm actually with the Administration for Community Living, something Secretary Sebelius just recently formed at the department. And a couple of points. The point about really beginning a dialogue with an individual about what their future is going to be like when they're living with a certain condition or towards the end of their life. There's a whole population of individuals living in the community today with functional need. And I would suggest that that's a great place to begin, to really start to reshape the dialogue that occurs between the individual and the clinician or the patient. If we don't begin to pay greater attention to those individuals that actually have the real life experience living in their communities and involve them in shaping how the services and supports and the treatments that they need are delivered to them, I think we'll continue to run up against the cost issues that we see today. Just listening to the dialogue, people are relatively uncomfortable with the idea of what their future might hold if they did incur a functional need. Again, there's a group of people living with it day to day. We've seen modest advances in the Medicaid program made where individuals are empowered to take some, be a bit more involved in directing some of the services and supports. There are certainly limits to which these individuals should be engaged in directing their health care services, but they're really at a critical juncture in terms of leading change. Another group that should be involved, and I think back to Ken's point, it's really a relatively modest investment because the community-based infrastructure that's out there to serve this population is really underdeveloped. And until we make some modest investments in this service delivery system, our medical system will just continue to strain to meet their needs. There won't be a partner in the community-based setting to make an appropriate handoff to when we want to just discharge someone from a hospital and make sure that they get the services and the care they need so that they don't end up back in the hospital. Unfortunately, we've learned this through implementation of the Affordable Care Act with the Care Transitions Grants. We're still making grants at HHS to our organizations that are prepared to do this, but we really know they're underdeveloped. And so for policymakers in the future, looking at making investments in something like what the Secretary has created in the Administration for Community Living really might be a sensible alternative to trying to continue to do this through a rigidly structured medical program that is involved in a political dynamic that's been pretty thoroughly discussed here today.
Enrique.
Thanks. Enrique Martinez Vidal from Academy Health. I'm the director of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation State Coverage Initiatives Program, and I also ran the State Quality Improvement Institute for several years, a Commonwealth Fund funded, where we worked with 8 states on quality improvement delivery system reform. And just to give you a few more examples of what states are doing out there, Ken talked about Vermont, and I'll add a point or two of that. But under our State Quality Improvement Institute, states really wanted to focus on how to deal with costs. I mean, they called it quality improvement, but it was really how do we deal with costs. If you think Medicare has problems just cutting, reimbursement and cutting services, that's what Medicaid does, and they've sort of tapped that out at this point. They're to the end of the rope with that. So they're turning to another way to do this. Care coordination is a huge thing, delivery system reform, payment reform. A lot of states out there doing primary care, medical homes, trying to even get to ACOs in terms of Medicaid. Colorado's doing that. Even New Jersey's doing that. Oregon, which I'll give you a little bit more detail as well, is a little bit of a vision at this point, but they're really thinking broadly. Consumer engagement is a huge piece of that, not only financial incentives, but also the education piece Susan was talking about. Health literacy was a big piece, as well as sort of the wellness programs, and how do you do that sort of ahead of time? How do you stop, the costs from even occurring? Health information technology was a huge underpinning aspect to this, bringing all the sort of how do you have the interoperable aspects to it that was critical. And then the metrics, accountability for having this all. So that was sort of the overall package of work that we had done in a number of these states. Vermont, as Ken really laid out, this community health teams, I think, was a visionary aspect to what they did. That was all built around the medical homes. They're still trying to figure out how to get to sort of the next layer out with specialists and hospitals. But they also had a health information technology that underpinned the whole thing, registries, interoperable electronic health records, and accountability metrics and for outcomes. The other, just one last point, what Oregon is trying to do with their coordinated care organizations, it's still a bit of a vision, but they have gotten a CMS waiver to implement this. It's a huge undertaking. It's going to be Medicaid, the state employees, their high-risk pool, CHIP, and they're hoping to bring in exchanges as well eventually when they get up and running. It's really to sort of integrate and coordinate benefits and services. There's local accountability for health and resource allocation, standards for safe and effective care, and a global budget that's indexed to sustainable growth. They have a website that explains all that. I would recommend that people go and look at the coordinated care organizations that Oregon is putting together. So that's just a few examples of sort of real work on the ground.
Thank you. Diane.
I just wanted to go back a little bit to where Brad was about people ending up in the hospital in the last year of life and right in the last months. And sometimes we learn from research and sometimes we learn from personal experience. And we've talked a lot about the coordination of care, which is basically in the community. But I think there's a different situation that we also ought to focus on, which is that my mom had a really good primary care team and coordination when she was in the community. And then she ended up in a hospital to be treated for dehydration, and then she ended up in the hospital longer and longer. And the hospitalist took over, and I couldn't get anyone to answer any of my questions, and the hospitalist kept turning over and turning over. And I think that finally I just got her discharged and brought her back home. But I think that we can talk a lot about coordination of care when they're not in the hospital, but we need to also be looking at the whole trend in the hospital toward hospitalists and what that means for the ability for the care to be managed.
Thank you. Susan?
Yes, I also wanted to mention around this interprofessional collaboration, which is the foundation of care coordination and the infrastructure that was being mentioned down there. There are some things that are happening, and some of this can be pushed from the public side, and some of it is being pushed from the private side. So on the private side, you have foundations like the Commonwealth Fund, for example, that has done work on the Mary Naylor and the Eric Coleman, but also trying to get people trained in that. I think that's really important. People who are already out there, not just the new students, which is really very critical. And there's the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, do a tremendous amount of work. We're at ARP, we're working with them on the Institute of Medicine Future of Nursing work that has a high priority on interprofessional collaboration. We have 49 states with action coalitions that are, many of which are making this a high priority across the state, across different disciplines. It's very, very challenging. We know that there's been efforts before to do this, but you also have HRSA now saying, tying funding for education of all professionals to interprofessional collaboration. So there's lots of different things that I think are efforts in place that I think we should all be trying to reinforce, because it's got to be done from the ground up, and we have to change the culture in the among the existing professionals.
Great. Thank you. Bob Helms?
Okay. One of the major topics today is technology, but I've heard very little discussion about the process of innovation. I think we all sort of believe in science and want to think that there's possibilities for improvement in innovation in technology. But a lot of the literature over the years has complained, with a system both private and public dominated by fee-for-service, that the incentives are more sort of cost-increasing innovation as opposed to cost-decreasing or value-seeking innovation. So my question to the panel is sort of, is this distinction important? And as long as we stay in Medicare and the private sector, a system dominated by fee-for-service, how do you get this sort of change in incentives for innovation into the system?
Joe?
Well,
either Joe.
This Joe?
No, you first.
Okay.
I
spring for Joe. Obviously, incentives are important. I think there's an issue about, from the public financing or even the private financing point of view, about who gets those savings, assuming there's innovation and savings occur. So Jim Fasulis said there has to be some incentives for the provider. I'm somewhat concerned about increased market power of providers, that they may appropriate most, if not all, of the incentives or savings, I should say. But that's obviously speculative. So I think as risk gets pushed down toward providers, and I believe that that should occur to some degree, that would increase incentives for providers to demand cost-saving innovation. But then who gets the savings?
Okay, Brad, and then Carmela, and then we will wrap up.
A couple of points. Care coordination, we kind of talk about it, but we sort of assume that we're talking about coordinating care across space, geographically across settings. To Diane's point, care coordination, my experience, doesn't work unless you wrap together what happens in the hospital, what happens in the medical group, physician office, and what happens at home and community. It is possible, and there are models out there that bring all of those together. That's the only way to deal with hospitalists who don't want people to come back again and again. They just have to deal with it when it happens. So care coordination across space is critical, and unless it does that, it doesn't work. But care coordination across time is also important, meaning, and this goes back to Joe Newhouse's point, when you're well, why wouldn't you want to recover and do everything you can to do that? When you are super ill, your preferences change a lot. And tracking those preferences, documenting them, getting them into the EHR, and following them is coordinating care across time. And both of those have to happen. And again, there are models there that do that. Now, the second point is financing. Again, back to Joe, shared risk, shared savings probably is where we're going to end up. We have to have providers sharing risk with payers and with Medicare. But you can't just jump over to get there, because we're in the fee-for-service world, and it doesn't. You can't just go from here to there. We're paying $20 million a year ourselves to put these teams in place in order to save Medicare $2,000 per month per patient. Now, we're willing to make that investment because we know we'll get at some point to shared risk and shared savings, and we're talking with CMMI about doing that. But the little providers out there that aren't integrated systems can't possibly do that, and nobody, not everyone's going to become an ACO. So our proposal would be use these across space and time care coordination teams to allow independent providers, hospitals, medical groups, home care agencies to become virtual ACOs, and I'd make that as a specific actionable proposal, and then create interim financing to help people over the bridge to shared risk, shared savings. That's exactly what CMS wants to do. And there's got to be a way to pay for quality on the way. So, yes, you get paid for now, but you can't game the system. You have to make outcomes in order to get reimbursed. So that's going to take a lot of talking, but I think there is a concrete way to accomplish it.
Okay, Carmela, we'll give you the last word.
So my comment actually goes back to the proposal that Ken put on the plea Ken put on the table about, you know, prevention and diabetic care. And unfortunately, I have to agree with Joe Antos. Medicare is just this 800-pound gorilla that isn't flexible and doesn't move like that. And they try to create programs one size fits all. This is not about one size fits all. I mean, I think as we've looked at what's going on in the private sector, we have a lot of physicians in this country that are in one and two doctor offices. They're going to have very different needs and have different infrastructure that they need to build than physicians that are in groups or a part of an integrated system. And every time we have this conversation, we sort of forget about them. And I'm very much worried about them because they need certain support if they're not going to become a group, if they're going to actually survive in this whole new environment. And I also think we have to think of primary care very differently than specialty care. I found it really interesting that this was a meeting about technology, but we focused a lot about primary care today. I'm not concerned with primary care and technology. The data we look at shows that technology is used and overused and misused more by specialists than they are by primary care. And so I think we need different solutions for primary care than what we do for specialty care. Specialty care is very much oriented to procedures and technologies. And I'll go back to something Jim said. We do a good job of teaching physicians in training how to use technology. We don't teach them when not to use technology. We don't teach them, and it's okay to say no. And that's a real challenge, particularly for a physician who has spent over a decade learning a specialty area, and they want to get out there and they want to practice medicine. And those, to me, are some of the problems that we have to grapple with. I think all the discussion on primary care today and care coordination and care transition across the continuum of healthcare is extremely important. But when I think of technology, my radar goes to specialists, not to primary care.
Let me I'm going to rebut you here, Carmela. 30% of the echoes I read at Arkansas Children's Hospital were ordered by the primary care doc. They had zero yield. None were needed. And I'll refer you to the pilot program we did with nuclear studies down in 10 settings. Yes, specialties order more tests because we have, that's part and parcel of the modern stethoscope, as Joe kind of mentioned. At the same time, if you look at the inappropriate rate of the specialist versus the inappropriate ordering rate of the primary care doc, which accounts for about 30% of the tests being ordered, it's 50 to 60% for the primary care doc, and they don't need the test at all. They're trying to figure out what's going on with the patient, and they order the test because they don't know what's going on with the patient. The specialist orders the test in a patient who already has the disease to make a decision, and their inappropriate rate is doing it too often. It isn't doing it as someone who has the study. So it's a two different aspects of the testing. And again, you can get about a 30% reduction on unneeded, completely unneeded testing by just having the primary care doc call the specialist and say, you know, what's wrong with this patient? Do I need to do this? And that's what our focus tool actually does. The tool sits on the electronic record and looks and says, is this an appropriate study or not? And if the primary care doc is ordering the test, it says call the cardiologist instead of ordering the test.
And I maybe just to respond in a similar fashion, you know, I actually want to rebut the comment too, because I think you just crystallized what I view as an internist as one of the single biggest problems, which is this highly, it actually goes to the example, Diane, that you gave, this highly fractured medical system where there's a plan of care in primary care and there's a plan of care in specialty care. This sort of fractured, patient-centered, but only through one lens of the patient. It's like, are you an outpatient patient? Are you a subspecialty patient? Are you an inpatient patient? That's the problem. You just crystallized the problem. And the idea that there would be a gulf between the primary care, the specialist, the inpatient system, and then, frankly, all the community-based providers, including the family, which we've not really talked about much today, other than one very important comment earlier. You know, And at the end of the day, sort of the failure of all the medical specialties to delegate appropriately, except when we choose to make the family responsible with almost no training. So I would just go back to this notion that there should be a care coordination plan that is person-centered, not patient-centered, particularly when you're talking about somebody who's chronically ill and functionally limited. And as long as we have these little silos, we're going to have a problem. And maybe that's almost a place to close on, which is care coordination is, in essence, a technology that we don't really know how to use very well. I mean, we all have there are examples of how to use it well, but sort of getting that rolled out could be important.
Thank you all for a terrific and vigorous discussion. I would note that depending on whether you are a glass half full or a glass half empty type of person, you heard a lot here that will send you one way or the other. I will say what I heard was we do have a lot of solutions, actionable solutions. Frankly, most of them are being tried. Now, maybe it's a case of more, better, faster. But most of them are being tried. We heard about the increased need for end-of-life, better end-of-life care, end-of-life engagement. Just a quick commercial for Health Affairs. Our June issue is devoted to a range of issues across what we call the care span, thanks to support from SCAN Foundation. Please read a piece by Bruce Vladek about dignity-driven decision-making, which I think is precisely what Brad Stewart and others have been talking about today as a prospect for really making headway on that issue. We heard a lot about care coordination. We know a lot of these efforts are already getting underway or are underway. We heard about the role of newly trained and empowered types of providers. Ken brought up the community health teams working in Vermont and elsewhere. We heard about the known successful interventions around the diabetes prevention program, the transitional care program, et cetera. That clearly is a case of more, better, faster, because we know that these work. We simply have to adopt them and put them to better use. We heard about the role of patient and family engagement. Again, clear evidence in the research that if you really engage patients, or as we otherwise call them, people, in their care decisions, they get better care and they're happier with the outcomes. We didn't spend as much time on some of the things that were on Joe Antos's list, but we know that those are out there. Those are changes in private insurance, whether it's moved to selective provider networks, value-based insurance design, et cetera. Joe, we completely left you alone on the notion of premium support in Medicare as being one potential. Maybe that's for our next session. But I think, again, just to close, we have a lot of evidence here that we have tools that work. And again, if you're a glass half empty person, we're not doing it enough. If you're glass half full, at least we're trying. And so there's a lot of perspective here for some additional inroads to be made in whether, again, it's the level or the rate of growth. We have some evidence that we can make a difference. So with that, let me turn things over to Ed. I think you're going to say a word or two about the next installment in this series.
Yes, thank you, Susan. We are going to start talking about solutions. We talked a bit about solutions today, but we knew that we needed to tap your brains on that aspect of it as well. June 12th, which someone pointed out to me is a Tuesday, not a Wednesday, we'll be convening the third and last briefing in this series in this space, but not in this time. We're going to start with a lunch and go to a reception, which will note the fact that this series is supposed to mark 20 years of activity by the Alliance for Health Reform. So I guess we can take credit for the health system's condition over the last 20 years. Let me just quickly thank our sponsors, our hosts, and most particularly our panelists and speakers for an incredibly good discussion, I think, of an incredibly difficult topic. And before I let you go, could you please, as you rise and collect your things, pull the blue evaluation form out of your packets and give us some feedback. And particularly, give us some notions of what we might do next following the wrap-up session in June to try to contribute to the dialogue that could get us some progress on controlling healthcare costs. Once again, thank you all for coming, and we'll look forward to seeing you next time. Bye.